You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website, trinitychurchdenver.org.
As I was considering these four verses this morning and kind of preparing all week, the story of C.S. Lewis's conversion kept coming to mind over and over and over and over again. If you've ever read Surprised by Joy, if you haven't, I strongly recommend it. It's a phenomenal book, absolutely phenomenal book. It's a story of kind of C.S. Lewis's life, particularly as it led to his conversion to belief in God and eventually belief in Christ. He tells the story of his conversion as the story of resistance, God dismantling his resistance to what was true. He humorously tells the story of encountering a handful of Christians. Reading G.K. Chesterton, one of them, and encountering the writings of George MacDonald, and being really, really frustrated because these men seemed intelligent and smart, and yet they believed in this crazy thing called Christianity. It's a wonderful story, and it culminates with this quote that I'll read for you. "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted, even for a second, for my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape? The words compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation." I read this story to you because it captures, about as well as anything I've ever read, the fundamental idea at the heart of the text that we're going to look at today, these last four verses of chapter 9. These four verses function as kind of a hinge. They're going to open the gates to some questions that we're not going to get to until next week as we start chapter 10. But they also close up or culminate or provide kind of a summary conclusion for us of the whole of chapter 9 and everything that Paul has argued for in this chapter in addressing, if you'll remember, the fundamental problem that's presented to us by the unbelief of Israel. That here is a people who had received the law of God, who'd received the promises of God, the wisdom of God. They knew the story, that they were the people that God had liberated from slavery in Egypt and brought into the land. He was the people that God had appeared to and spoken to again and again and again in their history. And Paul presents us at the beginning of chapter 9 befuzzling problem of this people who've received all of these gifts and yet have refused to believe, in large part have not come to trust in and believe in the work of Jesus. And so chapter 9 began by holding that problem in front of us, Paul did, and then answering that problem through this chapter. And so now in these four verses, Paul's going to pull together as a summary conclusion everything he said in this chapter. We know he's doing that because in verse 30, he begins with this question, "What shall we say then?" It's a phrase that's used by Paul periodically in his writings. It's when he gets kind of long-winded in his argument. He'll come to this question as a way of saying, hey, okay, everything we've just heard, how can I summarize that for us? How can we kind of create a conclusion now in the light of everything I've argued for prior to me asking that question? And so I want to create a summary for us of this chapter of where it headed as Paul paints a picture for us now of kind of his sum conclusion At the end of the chapter, kind of where the nuts and bolts kind of come together for us in these last few verses. So we need to begin now with asking the question, because it's an issue that's going to come up with a word that's used several times here in this paragraph. And it's the word righteousness. Paul's used the word righteousness a couple of different ways in the book of Romans. In the beginning, he used it to refer to the righteousness of God. And we talked about early on, really early on, like a year and a half ago, that the righteousness of God has to do with God's commitment to his keeping of the promises that he's made, doing all the things that he set out to do, which chapter 9 actually brings us, kind of confronts us with the problem of God's righteousness. That God had made promises to Israel, he made promises to Abraham, and for God to be righteous, for him to be good, he has to do two things. One, he has to keep those promises, and two, he's got to deal with sin. And so you'll remember at the beginning of Romans, it confronts us with the problem of the righteousness of God. He's made promises. If you remember a year ago, we would tell stories about my kids coming and wanting to go home after church and watch and invite all of your kids and come to our house, and we would watch all of the Lord of the Rings for the whole of the afternoon. And then me saying, yes, I promise we'll go home and we'll watch Lord of the Rings. And I get home and we're going to watch Lord of the Rings, and the couch is on fire. The house is being torn down. The TV is sawn into three parts. And I'm confronted now with the problem. I've made a promise and I've got to deal with everything is wrecked. That's the question of God's righteousness. But then we get to chapter 3, particularly verse 21, and then moving into chapter 4, the emphasis shifts now to the question of the righteousness of God's people, or another way to put it would be the status of a people that are declared by God who is judged to be righteous or to be in the right. And so as we begin to look at righteousness as it's used in this paragraph, it's not... it's not really looking at all the question of God's righteousness although that's the overall theme of chapter 9. What he's dealing with in these verses is the status of a people. Who will receive a decree from the judge that says you are in the right? And that's the question that he sets in front of us again here in chapter 9, and it's connected to the argument that he's made in this chapter. And what we've seen in this chapter is a couple of things. One, that who your parents are, your lineage, your genetics, kind of what line of ancestry you come from, is an insufficient grounds for receiving the verdict of righteous or in the right or being in a right relationship with God. Like, God doesn't say, oh, I see who your grandparents are or your great-grandparents are or kids, even who your parents are, and on account of that, I now place you in the group of people over whom I've decreed and declared you are in the right. Your sins are forgiven. You receive all of my promises. In other words, just because you're an Israelite, just because your parents were Christians, just because your great-grandparents were believers in Jesus, that is an insufficient ground on which to stand before God and make claims on him and make claims on his promises. The second thing we saw, remember this as it referred to Jacob and Esau. Remember verse 11. Though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, said, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. So then here's maybe more challenging to us in this room. Your good works is an insufficient ground for you to receive the decree of righteous or good or the inheritor of God's promises, or to find yourself in a right relationship with God. I would kind of use all of those as different expressions of why righteousness matters. No longer under the curse of death. Child of God. So if parentage isn't enough, nor is your good works, your humility. You put stuff in the recycling bin this week without putting the food in there. That you wore a mask enough in the right public places. That you only cussed when absolutely necessary this week. We all know when it's absolutely necessary. That you came to church this week. That you prayed before lunch conspicuously so as to be a good witness to other people. None of these are sufficient grounds by which to receive from God the verdict of righteous, inheritor of my promises, one over whom death will not hold sway, one that will be resurrected on the last day and live with me forever. So you cannot come before God and either say, look at my grandparents, and have any grounds for salvation. You cannot come before God and say, look at my good deeds, and have any grounds for salvation. These are not sufficient causes, sufficient grounds for your salvation. So what is? Verse 16 told us. So then it depends not on human will or exertion, but what? But on God, who has mercy. So the only grounds of inheriting the mercy of God, the kindness of God, the righteousness of God, the promises of God, resurrection from the dead, the only grounds, the only grounds. It's not this or this. The only grounds is God who has mercy. This is how people are saved. And if you remember last week, the description of the nature of salvation, how it comes about, and the description that's given to us from the Old Testament, that God looks out at a world that's marked by rebellion, that's marked by sin, that's marked by not esteeming him or being indifferent to him, or maybe questioning, like, has he sufficiently provided enough proof that he exists? Looking out at a world like that. Or a world marked by people filled up with pride and self-righteousness and religiosity. Like, I'm good enough, I'm moral enough, I'm compassionate enough, I'm humble enough. Look, God, look at my humility. Look at my compassion. Look at my empathy. He looks out at a world that does that, which all of which is an insult to him. A people over which God would say, you are not my people. The name of it that's given to us from the prophets is, the name of humanity is not my people. And then in God's mercy, he renames us. Not because of our will, not because of our self-effort, not because of our own humility, but simply on the grounds of God's mercy. He looks out at humanity. He looks out at a people who don't deserve it. He says, I rename you. You were called not my people, but now I call you my people. You used to belong to no one, but now you're my children. And so with that kind of laying before us, Paul now pulls and provides for us a different illustration from the story of the Gentiles and the story of the Jews. So look with me at these verses and what he says. So this is a way of summarizing everything he's already said. So how do we how would we summarize all this? We would say that Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained it. That is, a righteousness that's by faith. But that Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. So we get all kinds of different ideas here. One, this theme of righteousness, and it's a righteousness that's grounded in, it's based in faith, or based in some sort of completion of the law. Now we're gonna get into the question of the law. We're gonna dive headfirst into that next week. Right now I want us to look at the nature of God's salvation, particularly in light of that C.S. Lewis quote. I mean, here Paul says, this is what's happened in history. Here's the moment we've arrived at. There's a people who God had told them, here's how I want you to live. Here's what justice looks like. Here's what mercy looks like. Here's what good moral living looks like. Here's how you're supposed to treat your neighbor. Here's how you should deal with railings on your house. Here's how to worship me. Here's how to come before me. Here's what I'm like and my character. Here's promises even about what I'm doing with the world and where I'm taking all of history. Here's the people who'd heard all of these things and set out to say, well, we want to be the righteous ones. We want to be the ones that get all of that stuff, that receive all of those promises. So they took this path, this way of living that God had instructed them in, and they set out and said, we're going to do these things. We're going to do them diligently. We're going to do them as perfectly as we possibly can because we want all of that stuff. We want all of those promises. What Paul says is they never got there. They never attained it. They set out and with great intentionality, they said, we want to be the righteous ones of God. We want all this stuff that he promises. What Paul says is they never attained it. And then there was this other group of people, oblivious. Had no clue how God wanted them to live. Hadn't received the law, hadn't even heard of the promises, didn't set out to get there, never set out to get there, never said, hey, if we can do this stuff the right way, then we can get all of this stuff from God. Oblivious to all of it. And they've been given all of it. That's Paul's summary of what's happened in history. The Jews had been given the law of God. They'd been given the wisdom of God. They'd been given case law to even show them how to work out how the law should work and all the different details of their lives. They'd been told the promises of God, what God intended to do in history, what he intended to do for his people, his righteous ones, the ones that would belong to him. They'd been shown all of this stuff, and they'd been seeing God interact in their history and redeem them and rescue them. They'd seen all of this, and so they said, you know what? We want that. We're going to go get that. And they never got it. And then here's us, stupid Gentiles, watching Netflix, clueless, no idea what's happening, like really into sitcoms. I don't know why I did the dance thing. And it's like we opened a door and it was just there, all of this stuff. The enormous promises of God to inherit the earth. Yours. The kindness of God. Yours, the absolute sovereign power of God, bent for your good and for your joy forever. Yours. The riches of his kindness and his glory to be enjoyed and savored forever and ever and ever. Yours. Not because you set out for it, not because you wrote out a plan and you did your kind of goal sheet and you did your task list and you said, you know what, I'm going to get this stuff. You were clueless. You woke up one morning, you put on your robe, you wandered in to the living room / kitchen to get coffee, and suddenly there was all this stuff. That's Paul's summary of what God's done. Now, you'll notice in all this that it's not very flattering to you and me. Do you notice that? It doesn't, like, honor your efforts at morality. Paul doesn't go like, hey, I know it's mostly God's mercy and kindness. Man, I'm really glad you came through in the end. Figured it out. You were smarter than everybody else. Wiser than everybody else. More humble than everybody else. So you might have something to hold on to, right? I guess some of you people were like watching The Price is Right. I was starting to do some real serious moral philosophy. Just thinking about how I might live. Then I discovered God. I discovered him. Then he gave me all this cool stuff. It's not the story. The story is you were watching Price is Right. I say Price is Right because I don't know of anything dumber on television. I mean, I'm sure there is, but I don't know if you've ever watched Price is Right. You were just clueless. And God, in his mercy, so that all, hear that, all things, all of his promises, all of his grace, all of his righteousness, all of the gifts that are given to God's people, are from him and through him and to him. Not from him, through him and a little bit of you, and to him, maybe a tiny bit of you. No, but from beginning to end, that all of us sitting in this room, if there's any inkling at all to worship Jesus, to love Jesus, to hear the story of the cross and think for a moment, and my sins don't stand against me anymore. If there's any of that in you this morning, from beginning to end, Paul says, that is the gift of God. That is holy and completely not because of your self-effort, not because of your noble desires, not because of your own virtue, but wholly and completely from beginning to end, the mercy of God. So that all glory would be his, all honor would be his, that forever we marvel at a God who saves, not a God who makes a way of salvation, but the God who saves. That's Paul's summary of what's happened. So I tried to come up with an illustration particularly suited for this COVID time. And the illustration I came up with is, we were talking the other day, my kids and I were talking, what do you miss most right now? We miss going to the movies and ordering popcorn and sharing that popcorn and watching a movie up on the screen. And right now, I guess there's some theaters you can go to, but they're not really showing any good movies. And so we were talking about thinking through like how hard it is to try to understand what Paul's explaining here. And here's the best illustration I can. Kids, let's say you wanted to go see a movie and so you came to your dad and you said, Dad, I want to go to a movie. Will you take me to a movie? And your dad said, son or daughter, I would love to take you to a movie. It would be my joy to take you to a movie. But in order for me to take you to a movie, here's what I want you to do. Not even in order for you to take you. Here's just how I want you to live. Notice some things. Son, you never make your bed. Daughter, there's always shoes in front of the main doorway when we walk in. Other son, no, first, only son. Only son, I often find half-eaten food in the back of my car, under the seat, months later. I would like that to not happen anymore. I'd like the trash to be taken out. I'd like the dog to not have his bathroom stuff in the backyard. I would like the garage to be cleaned more often. There's just certain ways that our house will be better if you'll live this way, if you'll do these things. So my son, my daughter say, you know what? We want so badly to go to the movies. We're going to do this stuff so that he will give us the gift or the payment of going to the movies. So they set out to do it, but they never do it well enough. And they never get to the point in doing those things that they can then come to me and say, Dad, look what we did. We're now worthy of, deserving of, we've earned the right to go to the movies. Take us to the movies. Paul says that's what's happened with Israel. That's what's happened actually with all kinds of people in humanity. Every time you hear or presume, I'm a good person. I mean, if there's a God, he'll accept me. And the reason I know he'll accept me is because I'm pretty good. I'm nice. It's like my kids, if they said, hey, if we could just do this stuff enough, then Dad will recognize it, look at it, and say, they've earned a trip to the movies. Contrasting with that, it's me just surprising my kids one day and saying, you didn't think you could even go to the movies, but I'm taking you to the movies today. Not because you did anything. In fact, the shoes, I tripped on them. I'll be back here to tell you we're going to the movies. And there's a weird smell in my car, but you guys can deal with it. But we're going to the movies as a gift. This is what God has done. This is the gospel. This is the mercy of God. This is the grace of God. This is how God saves. So, given those two groups of people, the kind of person that sets out and says, God will accept me, he'll love me, I'll inherit all the promises of God on the basis of me doing the right things. And then there's the other group. No, I just received this as a gift. What's the most foundational difference between these two groups? This is where we get to this last verse, verse 33, the quote. It's a quote taken actually from two different passages in Isaiah. Isaiah 28, which is what we read prior to this, part of me standing up here. And then the other passage is Isaiah chapter 8, verses 12 through 14. Now, the language in these two passages from Isaiah are actually some of the favorite bits of language used in the New Testament to describe who Jesus is, to tell us about the work of Jesus and the nature of how Jesus functions in the world. And it's two contrasting images that are held up about the nature of Jesus. One, he is the stumbling stone who would be taken and become the cornerstone. And that describes perfectly the centrality and what Jesus does. You see, the nature of the gospel is not coming and instructing us in putting forth moral effort. The nature of the gospel is it comes again and again, and I confront it with you again today, and it confronts us with Jesus. See, the difference between these two groups is not their morality. It's not their parentage. It's not their ethical effort or their moral philosophy. It is when they encountered Jesus, did they stumble? Was he a stumbling stone to them? Were they walking down the path of life, they encounter Jesus and they fall on their face? Or they encounter Jesus and they see here the cornerstone of a whole new thing that God is building. You see, the difference between these two groups is, what do you do with Jesus? You see, this becomes the question, the only question about the nature and the reception of God's promises, the kindness of God, the blessing of God, the decree of God that you are righteous. You inherit all of my promises. Death will not hold sway over you. I will sing over you forever. I will display for you my riches and my glory and my sovereignty and my holiness forever and ever and ever for your joy. The difference, did you fall when you encountered Jesus? Or were you transformed when you encountered Jesus? You see, he's a stumbling stone to some. When you encounter Jesus, this Jesus who lives the life that you and I cannot live, dies the death that you and I deserved to die, is raised on the third day for our salvation, reigns even now as King and Lord over all the earth. Did you fall or were you transformed? Now, why would you fall? These tips are out of it to where we're going next week, but I want to at least point forward to that. Why stumbling happens? I think people stumble over Jesus fundamentally because there's never been a clearer testimony to our own foolishness, our own wickedness, our own deadness. Like if we were basically good and just needed help, we wouldn't need the cross. If all we needed was some moral education, then the law should have been sufficient. If all we needed was the right political leaders, then my guess is that Jesus' ministry would have looked quite different than it did. You see, when you encounter Jesus, that the thing that causes you to stumble, the reason why the story of Jesus might seem foolish to you this morning, because at the foundation of the story of Jesus is a declaration that you're not worthy, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you can't save yourself. Humanity, with all of our best efforts, all of our scientific and technological ingenuity, all of our great moral philosophers, all of our great history of just learning and falling and picking ourselves up over and over and over again, that none of that could save us. So you encounter that testimony and we'll resist it with all our might. We'll call it foolish and stupid and insulting. Because at one level it is insulting. But when you encounter Jesus, confronted with your sin, confronted with your rebellion, confronted with your helplessness, and you see in Jesus the mercy of God, the call of God, the kindness of God, the promises of God freely given, well, then there is no stumbling. There is simply God taking you in his sovereign mercy and building you up on this cornerstone. You see, Jesus is the cornerstone of something that God is building, a new temple, a new creation, a new people. And you will either stumble over him or you will be built into him. But the call this morning is that we would be transfixed on Jesus, that we would marvel at Jesus, that he would see in him the mercy of God, the kindness of God, the grace of God, undeserved by you or anyone. You would see in him all of your sins dealt with on the cross. You would see in him the wisdom of God. You'd see in him the whole point of the law, the perfect fulfillment of all that God requires. That you would find glorious, beautiful rest in the one that has come to save, to redeem, to forgive, and to reign. Behold the mercy of God. Will you stumble over him? Or will you treasure him and be built into him? Let's pray.